Okay, let us continue. Let's move on to thesis two, the intensification of class struggle thesis, which is independent of the non-sustainability of Christ, capitalist crisis thesis. That is, it could be the case that the nature of capitalist crises are such that there's no trajectory towards non-sustainability, and yet there could be an intensification of class struggle if the processes that underlie that part of the theory were satisfactory. Ito and Rodrigo, in different ways, raised the question of whether or not my criticism was accurate, that is, whether or not it was the case.
Yeah.
You guys are a team. Whether or not the thesis of proletarianization and homogenization could be sustained at the appropriate level of abstraction, that is, the level of abstraction of capitalism in general. And Charity asked the question whether the proletarianization thesis might apply at least to some places in the world, if not to the developed capitalist countries.
And Guillaume
as well, right. So let's, since you didn't talk on the labor theory of value question, why don't you, explore this question of...
I meant this in a very limited way, and I meant it only in that, insofar as we want to chart our course using some combination of a socialist compass and knowledge about the structural possibilities around us, the part where we need to learn about what structural constraints or other types of constraints we're facing, we also need to remember that class, a very pure and simplistic and abstract notion of class where we conceive of society as composed entirely of capitalists and workers as the only two necessary units of analysis. But I'm sorry, I'm getting sick and I'm having trouble articulating myself. But the point is, insofar as we want to do political economy to help chart our course, we also need to remember to use class in a high level of abstraction and not just in a sociological manner, where it's at a lower level of abstraction. But it's both are necessary and useful for different tests, that's all.
Rodrigo, do you want to add to that?
Sure. No, think the proletarianization y la homogeneización.
Homogenization.
Okay, thanks. just like the process that have the effect to generate labor power communities. Just that. No, like no, the those elements like characteristic of the classes, but like effects of the process of the dynamic of the capitalism, effects that generate just labor power.
But remember what the role of these arguments are with respect to the theory of alternatives to capitalism. Now, it's true that you can form a very abstract concept of capitalism and its class relations in which there are only two kinds of roles or positions, capital and labor, and both are homogeneous. And there are unquestionably some kinds of analyses which are clarified by that simplification. But the issue that I was raising is whether those concepts are satisfactory for doing for doing what the intensification of class struggle thesis was an attempt to do, which was to give us some kind of expectations about what the course of class struggles in capitalism would look like. Rather than saying we don't have a clue, they could be anything. So the Weber's view about the likely course of class struggle in capitalism is, I don't have a clue. Right? He basically said it's entirely contingent upon all sorts of other things, and he wasn't prepared to make any predictions about whether class struggles would intensify, decrease, or whatever. Marx, I think, and most Marxists did make a prediction. By saying they made a prediction, I don't mean to say that this would occur independently of the agency of actors. No, it was a prediction about what the agency of actors was likely to look like under these kinds of conditions. And I think that the use of the idea of proletarianization and homogenization, therefore, for that prediction can't be posed at that level of abstraction. That's not the level of abstraction at which you can answer this question. What are the likely or most probable, or what would we expect to be, the course of development of class struggles over time? Knowing that the capitalism as such only has two classes doesn't help you answer the question, what is its course of? And that's why I think you have to, for that question, shift down to a lower level of abstraction. And at that lower level of abstraction, I don't think the proletarianization and homogenization arguments hold, at least for the developed capitalist countries. And I'm not sure they actually hold even for less developed or developing or third world, however you want to frame it, capitalist countries. Although, Charity, if you want to...
I just think we see more polarization. And like in countries, let's say, where there's a 30-something percent, 30% unemployment rate, or, you know, 30-something percent are in the informal economy, and such a high percentage are in the service economy, I think you do have more homogenization in the working class, and you have more polarization between the haves and have-nots. But,
I just think, though, even when if you look like in the informal sector in a lot of developing countries, you end up having those same relations of exploitation within the informal sector. So you still have capitalists, wholesalers, middlemen. So you end up having this, so you end up having like the formal and the informal, but you still have this intense structure that's quite...
Perhaps, but if we're looking at, I mean, are we considering living standards to be the factors that distinguish between, you know, homogenization and heterogeneity? Yeah. I'll just say it that way.
Well, living standards would be one criterion. The question of homogeneity is complicated. It's Marx's view is that it was basically interest that would be homogenized. So he wasn't saying that everybody does the same thing. The work of a machinist and the work of an agricultural laborer wouldn't be the same work. They do different things. But their interests would be the same because they'd be in the same exact position in their relationship to capital and in their relationship to labor markets. So the sorts of things which might divide interests of workers and make it less homogeneous would be things like skills. So skill differentials are one of the classic ways that homogeneity within the working class is reduced. It could be sectors. If there are some privileged sectors that have monopoly rents in them, which enables the employers of those sectors to offer much better working conditions and higher wages, sometimes called an aristocracy of labor in certain historical contexts. Well, if you have you could have sectoral divisions within the working class, which might not have much to do with skill. You know, the janitors in the privileged sector get paid three times what the janitors in the small firm sector, but they're not hyper-skilled janitors. They're just in that different employment structure. That could be another source of heterogeneity. So, you know, sectors and skills are the usual things that are invoked. In this context, this is not so much about things like gender or race or ethnicity, although those sorts of things, where you have heterogeneity in the working class due to skills and sectoral differences, those tend to be built on, around or connected to or reinforced by other sources of social cleavage. Race, ethnicity, in particular, gender is a little more complicated with respect to that, this particular issue, since men and women are frequently parts of the same households. It's a different kind of, raises all sorts of other interesting questions, but it's a different sort of problem. So the question is whether or not in Latin America, whether or not in Argentina, is it really the case that the working class is more homogeneous? There are fewer divisions and the divisions are not as deep along these kinds of dimensions.
Well, we have some specialists there. One actually studying teachers and is conducting a survey to see if there is a proletarization process. So we can ask Ricardo, Ricky, you want to explain? I'm sorry if you don't.
Okay, I was thinking about this thing of proletarianization and homogenization. If one thinks of this in historical terms, a worker from Argentina and a worker from the States is now more or less similar now than a century ago. And a working man and a working woman are more or less similar than a century ago. And a worker from the city and a worker from the country, are they more similar or more different than a century ago? My intuition is that they are more similar, no more different.
Now, when you say a worker in these different settings are more similar, do you mean an employee or do you mean a worker? That is, are you counting all employees as workers?
Yes, an employee.
Okay, so then it becomes a little less clear that it may be that the difference between a rural and an urban worker is less, but it may be that the difference between a privileged worker, a worker with good working conditions and job security, and a worker without those conditions is bigger. The difference between a worker, a professor at the University of Wisconsin, and a farm laborer, so to speak, is bigger now than it was 100 years ago, not smaller.
Well, in Argentina, the case is the opposite, because if you think about teachers, they now maybe are earning less than a worker from the industry. When a century ago, it was exactly the opposite. A teacher was a privileged worker, employee.
So wage differentials between occupations have declined in Argentina?
Yes.
Because wage differentials between occupations have increased in European and certainly in North America.
And within occupations.
Within.
Not since 100 years ago. Victorian England, you've had a lot more.
No, I'm talking in the last 50 years.
And to add to the whole city-rural divide, of course, I'm going to use Venezuela as an example because I've spent the most time there, but you have 87% of the country living in the city. So if we're looking at living conditions as something that drives our interests or that creates our interests, you have just more of general homogenization of the actual population. So they're being put under more similar circumstances.
But wage inequalities among employees have declined in Venezuela?
I don't know. I can't claim that.
I mean, I would be surprised in Argentina if inequality among employees, wage inequality, earnings inequality has declined. Maybe it's true, but
I don't know, but in
most places in the world, inequalities of earnings have gone up, not down.
I don't know. Besides the case of teachers, do you think that inequality, wage inequality increased in Argentina or decreased?
Inequality.
Wage inequality.
Yes, inequality.
In salary. Increased or decreased?
Increased.
In the last 30 or 40 years, let's say, you know, over the last 25 years.
Increased because of the growth of unemployment.
No, but we are not talking about social inequality. We are talking about inequality in salary within employees or workers.
That is the inequality in earnings attached to jobs.
Desigualdad salarial sería la traducción. Aumentó entre los trabajadores o no? Okay. Yeah. Increased.
So that works in the opposite direction from homogenization.
But again, you're using specific factors to determine what kind of homogenization. I don't think it just comes down to wage. I think there are a lot of factors that goes into driving people's class-based interests that we need to take into account if we're really going to think about, you know, if this homogenization question is important in thinking about mobilization. I think there are a lot of other factors.
Julia.
It seems to me like the next question would be, have people's interests homogenized? And I don't know that you would see that in very many places in Argentina. Do industrial workers and teachers now see their interests as more similar in Argentina than they did 50 years ago or in Venezuela? Even if wage inequality hadn't decreased, I'm not sure that we're coming any closer to people thinking of their interests as being the same. Is that?
But I mean, subjective interests. There can be a disjunction between subjective interests and real interests,
right?
Especially economically.
But both of those are valid issues.
In Argentina, if you think 40 years ago, teachers, there were little syndicalized.
Unionized.
And there were no... There were no strikes of teachers. Now you have that teachers have big unions, and they are one of the sectors of the employees that have the most of the strikes among the working class. And if you think about these two aspects, you can say that that teachers see their interests more close to the rest of the working class. When there are general strikes, they go together to the strike.
But not usually. I mean, they don't struggle together with our workers.
Yes. And then when there is a general strike.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but there is not many general strikes. I mean, they don't have assemblies together or...
none of the unions have assemblies together. But teachers now participate in Central Sindical
Union. National unions.
Right.
They participate and the principal dirigente. The principal leader of one of the national unions is a teacher now.
an example of union of foreign
language. So that was unthinkable.
Right.
There's so many criteria that we can use to define proletarianization and homogenization, and I think the subjective interests is, I think they're suggesting if some workers identify with others, that is, in a sense, an ideological homogenization. I think Marx's sense of the term was social polarization of interests, collective de-skilling, diminishing wage differences between workers, but increasing differences, increasing inequality socially between workers and capitalists.
Right.
I mean, there's so many processes that could be going on, and I think part of our problem is that we're talking across criteria to a certain degree.
Right.
And the other problem is that even if we were being consistent with the criteria that we're talking about, it seems, at least historically, that Marx's theoretical reasons or rationale for the forces that lead to proletarianization seem not to have been borne out. Marx's exposition on this is that capital accumulation will tend to de-skill workers and reduce their autonomy as class conflict goes on. That is, that de-skilling and proletarianization are, to a certain degree, a natural result of capital accumulation. And on another level, it's a specific strategy by capitalists to undermine workers' collective action capabilities. And I think we don't have a good sense of the counter-tendencies. I think those forces are real. You know, the antagonism between capitalists and workers and capitalist incentive to de-skill and, produce more technical change in a Marxian,
right,
classical ways are still there. The question is, what counter-tendencies are acting? Have the counter-tendencies overwhelmed the original tendency? And what's the long-term trajectory? And I think we don't know the answer to any of those last questions.
And there may not be a long-term trajectory.
And there may not be a long-term trajectory.
Right. Catherine, you.
Yeah, I just want to say quickly, that's one of the things that was sort of interesting about the first and the second point, is that they're very deterministic about what's going to happen. And so in this case, I think it's really interesting to ask, is there between having like conditions that are similar and then deciding that you have similar interests is not something that I think necessarily follows from having similar conditions, and that similar interests have to be seen by someone and lobbied for. And I mean lobbied in the more social sense of it, and constructed, rather than just automatically arising out of.
And there's also, of course, I think a rather deep and elusive issue in the definition of objective interests. I mean, this is an old problem, but of a particular character, which is that interests cannot really be defined just in terms of your positions. They also are defined with respect to alternatives. So at the very core of the envisioning real utopia's problem and the alternatives to capitalism problem is the question, who has interests in the alternative? And it could be that people in the existing structure in very different positions whose immediate interests over the disposition of resources in the here and now are often in conflict might both have the same interest in the alternative, in part because the alternative might eradicate those conflicts, enable them to transcend it. So for an example would be, this is bound up with Eduardo's question on this theme. If you consider people who are deeply marginalized in, particularly let's say in developing contexts, but this is true elsewhere, people who have been pushed out of the core of the economy and are really living on the margins. And you ask, do those people and do industrial workers with stable jobs in the core of the economy, do they have the same interests? Well, in the narrow context of the immediate present, they often have very conflicting interests, because resources that get allocated to the state to help alleviate the destitution of people on the margin might otherwise go to improve the quality of schools, the lighting, the crime prevention, or whatever in the core working class areas, and workers and marginalized people often are don't see themselves as being sharing the same interests. Marx sometimes was very disparaging of people who were really marginal, calling them lumpenproletariat, not a section of the proletariat, but kind of you know, the despised and dangerous criminal classes. But with respect to the alternative, they could have absolutely identical interests. That is, a democratic egalitarian social structure under which the conditions for flourishing were distributed in a relatively egalitarian way would be a better context for both industrial workers and marginalized populations.
Yeah, but a situation in which there were conditions of human flourishing for the most part, but in which industrial workers were still somewhat better off than the marginalized, would be even more in their interest. I mean, you have to think about that. I mean, you know, this is a standard sort of game theoretic free rider kind of question, right? I mean, there's lots of things where there are collective interests, like obviously environmental collapse. But staving off environmental collapse while keeping a privileged position for capitalists is even more in the interest of capitalists than uniting to stave them off through socialism.
So this basically depends upon how much of an improvement in the quality of life and the conditions for flourishing and the reduction of risk for people who are in relatively secure but working class positions in the existing world. How much of an improvement is that relative to the difference between them and these marginalized?
But also whether it's dependent on their changing and their putting in their lot, right? I mean, if they can simply try to maintain their position while everybody else makes society better.
Well, you're right. So there's lots of complications around how do you mobilize people, who's going to make the sacrifices. But in terms of the question of are these groups homogeneous or heterogeneous with respect to interests? They could be basically homogeneous with respect to the interests in the alternative and heterogeneous in respect to their interests in the present. And that sometimes is described as contradictions between immediate and fundamental interests, for example. That their fundamental interests are the same, but their immediate interests are quite antagonistic. And that one interpretation of Marx's thesis about homogenization and proletarianization is that the tension between immediate and fundamental interests is reduced. That is, that groups become different segments of workers not only share fundamental interests, but they also share immediate interests because they immediately confront capital and the state in the same way, as opposed to in differentiated ways. So partially what work in the theory, the notion of homogenization is meant to do, is to help explain the reduction of conflicts within the working class over the spoils and the possibilities of the immediate situation, not just the long term. And clearly, struggles for fundamental transformation are enhanced where there is a correspondence between the kinds of solidarities you form in your immediate struggles for immediate gains and defense and the kinds of solidarities you would form to transform the basic institutions. If those are the same solidarities, that's a simpler context for collective action than when one set of solidarities is in tension with the other. Catherine?
Just the idea of the contradictory places within class location and also the increased mixity of people from different classes that was talked about is one of the reasons why we don't have this, the intensification of class struggle. I sort of wondered if those contradictory locations and the increased mixing between classes couldn't actually help achieve the goal by helping people better understand what they do have in fundamental interests. Because there's more exchange between groups than you would have otherwise.
If the exchange between groups, though, people give people individual solutions to the problems they face within capitalism because of mobility, for example, then it probably doesn't reinforce solidarities.
The contradictory class location is the middle class, I guess. Usually it's not so interesting. change, at least if you can reach a position with material gains, like social mobility or within your work trajectory, and it seems historically less supportive of radical change, political, social change. Yes. I had a question related to this. Obviously, Marx finished the Communist Manifesto, Workers of the World, so he's addressing a certain class for the political project of change. And Rahul mentioned classical reformism that were also addressing workers, even if they didn't take the revolutionary strategy. So, but I wanted to ask you, what are the real utopias? If, as an author, you have any social class or sector, or it's not a relevant question for you, if there is any relation to this tradition, like, well, not workers, then what, or it's not relevant.
It's graduate students.
Graduate students.
We all call
turn. Sociologists of the world unite. You.
Yeah.
We have to lose.
I think there are two audiences, not for the, you know, there's a separate question of who am I writing for. That's, you know, I'm writing for intellectuals who are interested in these questions and who want to worry about these ideas. But in terms of the agents for real utopias, I think there are two audiences which overlap, and the degree of overlap is quite variable. One audience is all those whose conditions of flourishing would be enhanced by a democratic and egalitarian alternative. Now, that's potentially a very large part of the world, right? That is, arguably, one could even say, for that, with respect to that idea, people whose lives and conditions for flourishing would be enhanced under democratic and egalitarian conditions, could even conceivably include some capitalists, right? That is, there are capitalists whose lives are heavily damaged by the forms of competition and the nature of insecurity and anxiety that's generated by the nature of competition, which in which their lives would go better under egalitarian. And so, I mean, Engels was a socialist because, in part, of a belief that the world would be a sweeter and more wonderful place to live under socialism than under capitalism, even though he was a capitalist, an owner of cotton mills. So partially, the answer to the question, who are the agents, it's anyone who comes to realize, or could come to realize, that the conditions for human flourishing under egalitarian and democratic conditions would enhance their conditions for flourishing as well. Now, that's that way of framing the audience or the collective agent is appealing to the interests of people. It's just saying, asking of someone, well, if you think this would be good for you, join us. If you don't, I'm not appealing to you, right? So, and my guess is that there's relatively few rich people and relatively few capitalists and relatively few people privileged under existing distributions of power and property who would find the prospects of a democratic egalitarian society an attractive alternative, because after all, it's somewhat speculative and there's a lot of risk involved in the struggle for it, and at least they've got a good thing going in the existing world. So there's all sorts of reasons why I don't anticipate people who are privileged to be part of the collective agency for any transformation. But I don't believe that's a principle. I think that's because of the empirical, practical questions. So that's, but one audience is basically still based on interests, I'm saying. And I, just as in classical Marxism, you'd ask of a person, do they have interest in socialism? And the answer is unequivocally yes for workers, and it's ambiguously yes for the middle class, and it's probably no, but maybe yes for capitalists. Because some capitalists would have interest in socialism because they hate being capitalists because it's a lousy way to live. But still, that's just the interest argument. But I also stress the social justice argument, the normative argument. That is, which is really why I think the reason why Engels was a socialist was not actually because of a cost-benefit analysis on his part as to whether it was in his personal interest. It's because he felt it was a better way to organize social life for humanity. And he identified in a moral sense of common humanity with workers. But it was a social justice reason, not a self-interest reason for Engels. I'm speculating, but that's what I suspect. I think, as I emphasized in chapter one, I think that the moral considerations for why one should want an alternative to capitalism are central to why one would want to criticize capitalism, but I think they're also central motivationally for why people would join in whatever collective forms of agency there would be. Where those two things go together, you know, where you have a social justice argument and a self-interest argument joining together, as, for example, in the civil rights movement in the United States, the Martin Luther King's calls for civil rights were always couched in moral terms. But why? It's not surprising why the appeal was much more powerful for African Americans than it was for whites. It's not because the moral issue was any more pressing for African Americans than for whites. It's the same moral issue. It's unjust to deprive people of equal rights with respect to education, transportation, and so on. The injustice of it is just as morally imperative on people who don't suffer the injustice as those who do, but it was also in the interests of African Americans. That is, their lives would simply be better under just conditions than under unjust conditions. And so the core agency remains, I think, workers and near workers, because for them there's a tight correspondence between the social justice and the self-interested formulations. And as that gets weaker, then people have a more, a less strong attachment to this potential agency. That was a long-winded answer to your question, but let's move on to thesis three. Thesis three and four are kind of together. Some of the same issues got raised in different ways. The revolutionary transformation thesis argued in the classical Marxian framework that because of all of this intensification of class struggle and increasing capacity to struggle that involved, and because of the weakening of capitalism, at some point those two curves cross and capitalism as an institutional structure becomes weak enough and the collective capacity to challenge it strong enough that a successful challenge can occur. The precise formulation of that idea, successful challenge, means that the superstructures which prevent transformation of capitalism cease to be able to block the challenge. Because the nature of revolutionary challenges is not directly that a revolutionary challenge is a challenge to capitalism. Rather, it's a revolutionary challenge to the institutions that protect capitalism, the state above all. And once that challenge is successful, because capitalism is weak, the revolutionarily successful political party or movement in control of the state is able to transform the underlying economic structure. That's the revolutionary transformation thesis. And I expressed skepticism towards the revolutionary transformation thesis for reasons separate from just the feasibility of revolution. That is, if you reject thesis one and thesis two, then the very possibility of a revolution becomes questionable, not because it would be a bad thing, but because the conditions for its success wouldn't exist. So if you don't believe that crises are going to intensify, and you don't believe that class capacities have any particular tendency to become greater over time, then it becomes less plausible that you could form the kind of mobilization with the sort of capacity capable of toppling states and countries and places like Europe and the United States. Empirically, it's never happened. That is, there's no example of developed capitalist states. I think Adam Shavorsky says there's no example. He calculated what the per capita income is. There's some per capita income, I think it's above $4,000 per year or something like that, in which there's no example of a revolution in human history against states in societies with a per capita income of above $4,000 a year or something like that. Be that as it may, that was a calculation Adam Shavorsky did. There certainly has been no socialist revolutions in any developed capitalist society, and few attempts. There has been no successful ones, and very rare even attempts at having such a thing. Some people say, for example, that the strikes in France in 1968 were, you know, a revolutionary situation. I just think there was nothing remotely like a revolutionary situation in 1968 in France. There was a situation that was certainly explosive, and political changes could have been quite profound, but there was nothing that would have... there's no scenario I can imagine in which it would have led to a toppling of the French state and the installation of a socialist project. So in any case, but I think there's reasons to be skeptical quite apart from those the problems of the first two. Yeah, that's that newspaper is from the great days of 68. And that had to do with the problem of the nature of the concentration of power that a violent ruptural overthrow entails, and whether or not it's consistent with the sort of democratic experimentalism needed for the result of ruptures to actually be democratic egalitarianism. The way, as you know from reading the chapter, the way I framed it is that the kinds of organizational weapons needed to overthrow states do not seem well suited to constructing democratic egalitarian alternatives. And both Wes and Rudolfo raised questions about that. I think Rudolfo raising a skeptical question, you know, maybe that's not true. And Wes being less critical, but trying to nail it down a little bit more. So if you two want to say something about those themes.
Yeah, the general point was in a theory of transformation, we have to think about what kind of future we want. So agreeing completely with your point, and then just thinking about, okay, what does that mean in terms of the types of strategic institutions that are built, or the types of really utopian alternatives even necessary for creating this transformation, right? Does it lead us to want to think about it in terms of means and means matching the ends, right? If we wanted a democratic egalitarian future, do the means for reaching that future have to also be democratic and egalitarian? So political parties or unions or whatever types of alternatives are working towards a transformation, do we think about building those in a democratic egalitarian way as well, and how strong of a necessity or desire is that, either scientifically or normatively? So that was my question. So.
Rudolfo.
Mine was more than an analytical concern, more a political concern. Because this book is very political. It's about the proposal of change in society. And I wasn't convinced enough by the rejection of the whole tradition of socialism in two pages, and I was asking for more clarification, historically and politically, including authors that developed this line of thought, which in Marx is not as developed. That was one thing. But then in your reply you said that real utopias is not necessarily opposed to a revolutionary strategy,
right?
Which really shocked me, because my comment took that as an assumption,
right,
that real utopias was in fact another alternative, it was Bernstein's reformism, another alternative, but different and trying to address new problems and new actors and things. So maybe, I mean, my question would be that, why not? I mean, why do you think it's not opposed? Or
so the idea of envisioning real utopias is about the, how do we think through the institutional designs of alternatives? The second question is, what are the conditions under which those alternatives could be put in place? So those are two separate questions. So just as an example, I consider unconditional basic income, the idea that every person in the society, where we define what the boundary conditions for that is, that's a separate question. Is it all people who live in a place, or all citizens, or all adults, or what? But let's not worry about that issue. All people in the relevant category unconditionally get an adequate standard of living to live a decent but not extravagant quality of life. So people get the kind of no frills but morally and culturally acceptable standard of living, unconditional upon any contribution that they make to the society. An unconditional basic income, a generous unconditional basic income. Now, for reasons we'll see in a couple of sessions, I find that an extremely attractive institutional design. I think it has all sorts of positive characteristics. It could be that the only conditions under which you could ever really institute that would be ones in which you've already destroyed capitalism. That is, it could be, and I used to argue but no longer feel as confident, that the necessary condition for a basic income was already having socialized the means of production, the principal means of production. So, because as long as capital private owners were free to disinvest and move their capital, then a basic income couldn't be sustained. If you institute it, you would destroy its own conditions of possibility because of disinvestment and capital flight. Now, if that's true, then one might say, well, basic income is a good design, it's viable, but it would take a revolutionary rupture with capitalism in order to institute it. The analysis of the viability of the design does not require that you have solved the problem of under what conditions is it achievable. And achievability might require revolutionary ruptures. That's why there are these three chapters at the end of the book on ruptural, interstitial, and symbiotic transformation. And I treat the ruptural one seriously because it's not clear to me in the end that ultimately ruptures might not be needed. Now, I'm skeptical about the possibility of ruptures accomplishing what people want them to accomplish. So my worry about ruptures is not a moral one. I don't have any principled objection with, you know, smashing the existing institutions and building alternatives. If such a strategy could achieve the goals intended by the actors, I think the historical record gives us pause as to whether or not ruptural strategies actually achieve democratic and egalitarian and emancipatory goals. And that skepticism, if anything, I think would not be alleviated by the shift from poor countries to rich countries. That is, one of the arguments for why they failed to achieve the goals in poor countries is because the level of development of the forces of production was so adverse to the possibility of a democratic and egalitarian reorganization. But on the other hand, they were relatively simple social structures, and the institution-building tasks were relatively simpler in Russia of 1917 than it would be in a complicated and differentiated place like the United States or Europe. That's basically my thinking, and that's why the revolutionary question and the real utopian question are not inherently opposed to each other. I have to be somewhere to which I think I am forced by circumstance to walk rather than ride my bike in about a half hour. And therefore, I think we have to draw this to a close today. We will meet in 2 weeks from today. And since you have 2 weeks to prepare your interrogations, if instead of having them arrive distributed between the Tuesday and Wednesday of that week, 2 weeks from now, if they could arrive in whatever sequence distributed between Monday and Tuesday, so I'd have them all by Tuesday. That would be better for me. Then I could calmly get them all done, and we'll be ready to go for 2 weeks from now. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. And I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Bye.
Bye.